Welcome to the Forgiveness Lab podcast. Forgiveness is not just something God does, it is the deep expression of who God is in every part of our lives. We're here this morning in Syracuse, New York, at Bethany House, the home of Tony and Linda Bartlett. It's a joy to be here. This is also the home for the Bethany Center for Nonviolent Theology and Spirituality. I've really been looking forward to getting together again with my friend Tony Bartlett. It has been actually 12 years since we've seen each other face to face. I'm grateful for this opportunity. Tony is a teacher, a theologian, and a writer. He actually has led a pretty fascinating life, and hope we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about that along the way and unpack some stories. I first became familiar with Tony at a Making Peace conference back in 2007, and at that time I was reading your first book, Cross Purposes, about atonement. And I, in spite of what you point out as the density of it, I found it quite profound. And atonement theology, to me, is a critical element of Christian theology. And how we understand atonement has everything to do with violence and nonviolence. Tony's also the author of Virtually Christian, How Christ Changes Human Meaning and Makes Creation New. That was like an opus. And also Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible, which is fascinating. And you're also a novelist, Pascal's Wager, Homelands of Heaven. And we're here today, well, to talk about forgiveness. And since it's my understanding, as you know, Tony, that God's forgiveness is in everything, we'll be celebrating that in our conversation together. So normally I would say welcome to the Forgiveness Lab, but it's you who's welcoming me into your home.
Well, it's great to have you here, Scott, and thank you for that introduction. We have known each other for quite a long time, 12 years ago now, and that's when we were engaged for the first time in kind of researching and teaching and kind of proclaiming this other vision of atonement, of what God was doing in the death of Jesus, his son. And those were kind of like exciting days, and then we kind of settled back, or things life went on, and we kind of concentrated more on our, we did, and I think you did, on our local engagement and work. But it's wonderful that you've made a reconnection, and you've kind of sewn the threads back together again, and we're here face to face after quite a long time. So it's great to be able to have you here with us at Bethany, and for you to share last night in our small Woodhouse Hope community meeting. And I'm privileged to be able to share the podcast with you, the Forgiveness Lab. Great title. God is forgiveness, isn't it? Doesn't just do it. You know, that's your theology. That's what you work with, work on. And you were telling me last night about your forgiveness circles, or your healing circles with vets, with survivors of moral injury, PTSD. Really important things, really important work. At the developing edge of the Christian mission certainly in North America today. So yeah, forgiveness is a great topic, and it's great to have you here to be able to share on that. Cross Purposes, my first book, which was written out of my experience at the university here in Syracuse, Syracuse University Religion Department, and it carried some of the aftermath of a dissertation with it. The sense of having to be defended in a committee, and to have to cross all the T's and dot all the I's academically. But yes, there was an important message there. It was it's a major shift. And it's not just me who's been writing in that field or working in that field. A major shift in understanding the meaning of Jesus' death, not just in terms of the forces that are arrayed against him that we hear about in the Gospels, and it's very dramatically told. But what's the significance of that cosmically? How does that work to change the nature of things? and to change the nature of our existence and how we stand before God. Those questions became really crucial to me. And I kind of basically came to the United States to work and study in the Department of Religion in Syracuse in order to try to answer them. I mean, that was actually always in my mind, mm-hmm. always right from the very beginning. I'm not sure the professors, the department always knew that I had to keep that secret to some degree. Otherwise, they wouldn't have accepted me. But yeah, that was a major issue.
It's a stealth mission.
It was a stealth mission. And it goes back to Anselm of Canterbury. I mean, like that's the major player that you're talking about, that you're engaged with. The conversation partner, he's a 12th century Christian monk from, actually he was Italian, but he worked and was an abbot in north of France, Normandy, and then eventually the Archbishop of Canterbury under the English kings. And he's an incredibly pivotal figure in terms mm-hmm. of what he did, setting out the notion of atonement that we've inherited, and the Protestant Reformation inherited it as well, with some shifts, but basically the same thing, that God was being paid off, mm-hmm. essentially, that their satisfaction had to be made, that was the word, satisfaction had to be made to God's offended honor and righteousness by any human sin. The slightest human sin demanded an infinite compensation, and that was really his argument, and that's why Jesus had to be both human in order to die, but God in order to offer the infinite payback. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty horrendous theory, really.
agree with you there.
But it stood the test of a thousand years.
Yeah. And it rings true with dimensions of the human psyche.
That's right. And it's absolutely a capitalist theory. It's a banking theory that the bank had been drawn down and was basically bankrupt and had to be paid back up again. You know, it's like a transactional theory. And it went along with the whole mindset of Western Europe and North America. But we're at a different point in time now. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Indeed. Indeed. I actually recovered a quote of yours that I want to read to you, because this is one that I have I've come back to again and again. You put this so well. You write, "The whole world has been set in motion toward the new humanity of Christ. As the world is unlocked from its archaic orbit around death and violence, the sense of instability is immense and dangerous. But at the same time, for those with eyes to see, the new center of gravity is experienced. The wonderful thing is that as it comes into view, we understand that it has been at the core of things all along."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think was part of the introduction, was it? Or something of Cross Purposes?
Yeah, yeah, trying to. That's definitely from Cross Purposes.
Yes, yeah, summation there. That, yeah, the idea that to understand that rather than God being paid a compensation for offense, for a debit that had to be made up in the kind of banking order of things, that actually God was at the core of things, at the heart, as the quote says, mm-hmm. pouring out this love, this life, this forgiveness, this, or in your word, your beautiful neologism, givenness, Scott, that God was always at the heart of things, mm-hmm. doing that, and it's much more consistent and holistic with the Bible, with the whole of the Bible, that's the nature of God, rather than imposing on the text essentially this mechanical transactional theory, although people, you know, are convinced that it's there in the text, mm-hmm. that it belongs to the text,
right.
So it's almost a struggle to go through and to understand things over again with fresh eyes. But once you do, it's a beautiful experience, and liberating and life-giving.
Mm-hmm. When I think about, you know, we're talking about the death of Jesus, but the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus together.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jesus' life, you know, the manifestation of God's love
mm-hmm.
in a human being.
Mm-hmm.
planted in the midst of the world, in actually a very small little way, in a little sort of, and not very to diminish local. It at all, in very local, far away from where things often are hustling and bustling.
Easily forgotten.
Easily forgotten and lived out in human encounter. I'm trying to think of who it was. I read an article not that long ago. Well, actually, it was probably several years ago, but that talked about Jesus, because Jesus didn't have one place that he called his home. And it was riffing off the, you know, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. You know, foxes have dens, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. That actually, an understanding of that is that because Jesus was not, and did not allow himself to be rigidly defined by a certain town, by a certain social group, by a certain
tribal identity
that he was in many ways available to everyone where they were and came to where they were, and that there's that there's a kind of forgiving life in that, that is always open to people right where they are.
Yeah, that is something about Jesus' story and ministry. I mean, there's always this tension that Jesus has to fulfill the goals and the purpose of Israel. So he says, go first to the lost sheep of house of the house of Israel, do not go deviate out to the left or the right. And he sends his disciples out to preach in the towns of Israel. But then he himself deviates. I mean, he goes outside the territory of Israel, goes to the territory of Tyre and Sidon. And the moment he does that, the moment he breaks from the strict defines, the strict confines of Israel, and of course that itself is a social construct, because what were the strict confines of Israel? If you go back through the Bible, that becomes harder and harder to identify. But assuming they did exist at that time, and you would probably talk about Judea a lot, but the moment he goes outside of that and encounters somebody, encounters a Syrophoenician woman, the Canaanite woman, and actually imitates the pathway, trajectory of Elijah when he went to the area of Sidon, and kind of ministered to the widow of Zarephath, that when he does that, when he moves outside that orbit and he invokes the prophet Elijah as his justification, is that that is inherently nonviolent, you see, because once you cross the boundaries and talk to the stranger and the other, who is at least potentially an enemy, if not effectively an enemy, they're not us. Back then, it was probably even more clearly marked in more archaic societies that you were a stranger than in more modern cosmopolitan societies. But the moment you're outside your boundaries and then you minister to someone, you have to let down all your guards. You have to let down what they call the othering, the reason why you're not the same as that person, and what and why you might quickly come to blows and violence with that other person. You have to let go of all that, and you have to give yourself. And that's what that journey of Jesus did when he went outside of Galilee. He really showed them the nonviolence of God by reaching out to the other, which of course had already been prefigured and signaled in the Old Testament, as he himself says. So it's not like he's inventing it out of nothing, but he enacts it. And so there's something totally coherent about his death, his nonviolent death at the hands of the authorities and then of the Romans, non-retaliatory, non-abusive in reply. He was abused but did not abuse in response. That's all totally coherent. The moment he moves outside the safe boundaries of Israel, that there has to be a... And he, if he's representing God, if he's not just some kind of... If this is meaningful and intentional on his part, which of course, you know, the gospel shows it is, then he is manifesting this other way, this other understanding of God, when he says, no one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom he chooses to reveal him. It's an astounding comment. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. How can you say in a culture that has spent 1,000 years responding to this God, mm-hmm. and being obedient or disobedient, whatever, to mm-hmm. this God, but having a relationship, a very powerful relationship, through ups and downs and ins and outs of mm-hmm. history. And then Jesus comes along and says, no one knows this person. No one knows this God that you've been talking about.
Yeah.
It's amazing audacity or hubris even, but it stops being hubris because of the consistency of his life and right. of these actions and following it through. So there is, you know, undoubtedly a new manifestation of, or a much clearer, profound manifestation of the character of God as nonviolent,
right.
In the ministry of Jesus. And that's kind of what we've been unpacking, or I've been unpacking, you've been unpacking in our work for these past dozen and more years. And of course, with you, that has taken you, and I was very thrilled to learn about it yesterday, has taken you into the direction of ministry to those who are wounded in war,
right?
To veterans and the moral harm they carry. So this is this theology which we've just been mm-hmm. unpacking,
right.
is overflowing mm-hmm. now into the actual political and social reality of our time, marked so deeply by violence.
Yeah. You, wow, that was... I probably should just sit with what you said for a bit. You referenced a story that's always been an important story for me. And of course, it's in two Gospels where Jesus, you know, leaves Israel and crosses the
Jordan right,
to Tyre and Sidon.
Yeah.
And in Matthew, where the woman is identified as the Canaanite woman.
Right,
it's like the ancient foe.
That's right, yeah.
So she carries that designation, really. Mm-hmm. and it's obviously a long-standing one, because at that point in time, there really aren't Canaanites
in
the same sense. So so that those kinds of separations, those kinds of definitions and labeling of one another lasts a long time.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's an old slur, really.
Yeah, right. but not quite gone.
Yeah.
Something that has always been fascinating to me about that story, and really as we're kind of exploring what you were, you know, really reflecting on pretty deeply there about forgiveness, crossing of boundaries, about the nonviolent life, is in particularly in Matthew's version. Now, the versions are pretty much the same, but the ugliness that is confronted is even just a little bit worse in Matthew. And what's fascinating to me about that story is that, you know, Jesus does cross these boundaries, leads his disciples to a place where I'm sure they're probably profoundly uncomfortable. but then this woman appears and asks for his mercy. And his initial response is to not want to pay any attention to her at all. Mm. And when she keeps, you know, continues to try and, you know, beg him, you know, his disciples start complaining that, like, you know, their ears are hurting from the sound of her. Can't you just get rid of her? Mm. And then Jesus says this, you know, positively awful thing.
That's right.
About, you know, you don't throw the children's food to the dogs. And it's just, I mean, the horror of it. And in my own study and just in my own pastoral ministry, I mean, people have tried to find a million different ways to excuse the behavior of Jesus. But what strikes me in that story is that her persistence, her actually meeting him in this place where he now is, or at least where he's, you know, expressing himself, and even some kind of pacing what he says, but then said, you know, yeah, you know, but even the dogs eat the crumbs from the master's table, and just kind of takes everything and turns it over. I've always been impacted by that, because that really is a turning point in his ministry.
It really is, yeah.
And it is as though, and this is, of course, where theologically we struggle, or folks struggle, it is as though he is changed by his encounter with her.
Mm-hmm.
So in my paradigm, or just the territory I'm always kind of exploring, you know, she is the agent of forgiveness mm-hmm. to him and mm-hmm. for him, which of mm-hmm. course is somewhat blasphemous, but mm-hmm. but sure. at the same time is quite powerful. I think.
Well, I think it's what is one of the really wonderful things about the gospel, and one of the reasons why it stands up over the ages, the centuries, as a spiritual masterpiece or a series of spiritual masterpieces, is because there's always some kind of dialogue going on. I mean, it's not an abstract scholastic teaching that's foisted on, even, you know, even the way I phrase it, you know, that God is, this is a different kind of understanding of God. God mm-hmm. is nonviolent. These are, you know, they're good things to say, but they're abstract. What Jesus is always engaged in is some encounter, some dialogue. And it's the same scene, essentially the same scene in John's gospel with the woman at the well. I mean, there's this mutuality going on mm-hmm. between the two of them. And it brings out of Jesus that his confession about himself that I see you are a prophet, sir, and he carries on and actually reveals himself as the Messiah, and she goes back and says, isn't this the Messiah? She's the first messenger or apostle
indeed
of the Messiah in the Gospel of John. And she's this Samaritan woman. So there's always this kind of interaction going on. And this, the one you're talking about, is the Canaanite woman, is absolutely classic. It's almost like Jesus does this kind of street theater, but even that's too weak a phrase for it. You know, he rehearses the human condition. So he says something. I mean, this is my reading of it, okay. You know. Mm-hmm. It's not an apologia. It's just like a fun kind of dramatic reenactment, is that he rehearses almost the worst thing. Well, it is the worst thing. Uh-huh. It's what you said, that the history has done between these people. Mm-hmm. These are dogs.
Right.
These are dogs. They're dirty dogs. I mean, the Semitic people, the Arabs certainly, don't have the same relationship with dogs that we do. They don't have them in the house. They are dirty. Dogs are dirty. Yeah. But we love them, you know.
Yes,
because
yes, we do.
Because they keep us warm at night in the cold northern climate, you know, kind of thing. And they keep the wolves at bay. But, you know, he calls this woman a dog, and her children a dog, mm-hmm. are dogs, you know. And so what has been set up is hostility, is yeah. immediate. This is daggers drawn stuff, yeah. you know. If there were guys in a bar, the knives would be out.
Right.
But he says this to a woman. Now, why does he do that? Why does he do that? Is he doing it to be offensive? Mm-hmm. No, I don't think. I think he's doing it in order to overcome precisely. But he's making her do it. Mm-hmm. He's not enacting. He's not speaking an abstract doctrine. He's saying, here's the barrier. Here's the traditional offensive language and hostility to the other. I'm presenting it. Now, there is a door here you can get through. there must be a signal. There's a signal of the door. But she has to recognize it. That's the thing. She has to see that door. She has to see. She has to be able to see and say, ah, yes, Lord. But mm-hmm. even the dogs, mm-hmm. he describes. She says this. She comes out with this wisdom saying, mm-hmm. which turns the whole thing on its head.
Right.
Right from within. This is something that overturns the will from within the world, you know, and changes the perspective. So it's like an enormous semiotic shift is what, you mm-hmm. know, I talk about in
right.
terms of changing the sign values. He's set the drama, the theater production, mm-hmm. and allowing this voice to come forward. And then immediately, of course, he responds and says, because of what you said, mm-hmm. You know, your child is healed. So we suddenly find what's happened. We have almost there in that small passage, we have a whole Hebrew Bible, should we say, of the pagan people. I mean, like where they're coming to meet God, you know, mm-hmm. and it comes from within them. So what you've done, you've kind of restarted, you've reignited the story of salvation from outside the territory of Israel. And this woman, and she's a wisdom figure. Mm-hmm. And you can see that that wisdom would operate, that gives you a cue to say that that wisdom operates anywhere in the world, anytime, any place. Anybody who can turn, who can see the possibilities of nonviolence, essentially, mm-hmm. can reach out to the other across those huge divides, can restart the human narrative in a new way. And she does. Mm-hmm. And so he could then, as you say, he goes back to Galilee a changed person. I mean, yeah. His ministry is different now.
I mean, she insists on mercy.
Yes, she does.
And she's insistent about it. And I've often thought, you know, she is interceding for her daughter, and any parent can identify her anguish. Yeah. At the same time, and again, this is just my take, she becomes a kind of intercessor for Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, and what he's embodying, let's put it at that point, because it seems to me that his students, his disciples, are now being taught by her.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, if Jesus, you know, in John's gospel, he's identified as the Word, which is another expression for wisdom. It's kind of displacement of the, I mean, even the Book of Wisdom calls wisdom the Word. So if Jesus is wisdom, and wisdom belongs to the created order somehow, mm-hmm. God's wisdom belongs to that, and all things come to be through her agency in mm-hmm. some fashion. Then the gospel is going. That's going to happen. So it's kind of a mirroring effect between the two of them, between the woman, and she does provoke that. Because Jesus is capable of also being very Jewish, you know, and selectively Jewish, you know, and being within inside the boundaries, and salvation is of the Jews, and that's his position.
Yeah.
So there has to be this mediation, and it's not, and I've often thought that this is not a liberal position, in as much as that, you know, like there are many paths lead to God, and everything is valid as each other, you know. That is not entirely the biblical message, that there's something going on here which is unique. But at the same time, that uniqueness that Jesus is, it can arise anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a potential of our creation, it's a potential of our humanity. And I think that she definitely detonates that in Jesus, and you know, triggers it, and, mm-hmm. and allows it. So when he goes to Jerusalem to confront the Romans, he's not confronting them anymore in that sense of the national enemy. In fact, he doesn't do that. I mean, right. he doesn't do that at all. He's something else is happening, and he's learned that along the way. And these significant women. Mm-hmm. Like you say, mm-hmm. the Canaanite woman and the woman at the well, and Mary and Martha and Bethany, they've really helped him get to that position to understand and to fulfill his role and destiny. Mm-hmm. And I think the Gospels show that. So the Gospels are this wonderful kind of tapestry of relationships mm-hmm. that build up the whole picture. And they're still going on, right. Still happening.
And he has this life story that continues to develop.
Yeah.
And his own, I guess I'd think about it as his own deep humanity is constantly revealed mm-hmm. and in the context of these relationships.
Right.
And so, you know, the value of the story we've been talking about, I mean, the story itself has this power.
Yeah.
And we probably don't have to quantify all of that or figure it all out. Just receive some of that power, witness to it, that this, what I would call forgiveness, is moving in more than one direction. Right. It's a power that is, you know, just moving in and through a scene, and it's transformative.
Right.
Because really, as you point out, he crosses the boundary initially, and he does that. He makes a choice to do that.
Yeah.
But then it creates the opportunity for something new to happen.
Absolutely, yeah. He's kind of looking.
And that's what does.
Yeah. When he sits down at the well, and the disciples come back and say, well, why is he talking to this woman?
Right.
Well, because he's opening that opportunity, yeah.
Have you ever wondered why some of the characters that we're talking about, the Canaanite woman or the woman at the well, why their names aren't on churches?
Yeah, right.
You know, why isn't there like a woman at the well, United Church of Christ?
Yeah, right.
Since they really are these pivotal figures at different times in the story and in this tradition. It's, you know, and it's not that I have a problem with the name itself, but I'm pastor of St. Andrew's United Church of Christ, and before I was at St. John's United Church of Christ. So there's a similarity.
Well, I suppose it's entirely by accident these women, these people who are unnamed are women.
Right.
And so many of the women who are named in the gospel are Mary. Mm-hmm. So Mary is a very common name. It's always struck me as, I mean, it goes along with that, that the woman who anoints Jesus in Matthew and Mark at Bethany before his arrest, Jesus says, where the gospel is preached, what she's done will be told in memory of her. Mm-hmm. Well, who is she? I mean, how can we remember her if we don't know her name?
Yeah.
Right, in memory of this anonymous woman.
Right, right.
And of course, John kind of fills it in by semi-telling us that it's Mary of Bethany, but then she's a mysterious figure as well. She's the same as Mary of Magdalene, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But so, yeah, I think the role of women, which is a wisdom role in the Gospels, is kind of seething under the surface there. And by not naming them, you're not actually giving them hierarchical roles.
Right.
That's what it is. I mean, they're not part of the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Well, thank God for that.
Right. Yeah. So that's a reframing, which constant and the release of power that has been repressed.
Yes. Absolutely.
And so all of it's right in the story that we receive.
Yeah, right.
In the way it's told, the way it's edited, but this power bubbles up.
Yes.
And the story cracks open with all sorts of new life. And
It
seems to me that that's just constantly happening.
Yes, it is. And that is the power of the gospel. It's not a prefabricated, one-size-fits-all thing. You know, it is always bubbling up. And that, of course, it makes it painful and difficult as well, because it's not possible to control that bubbling up in relationships and in your own life. You know, you're always trying to adjust to it to discover what it truly means, where it's taking you, all that kind of thing. But it's a ferment of life, and it's the leaven of the gospel, and that's why it's alive.
Right, right. Whether or not we understand it at a particular time as a gift.
Yeah, right.
As the gift that it is,
that's
another matter.
Yeah,
You know, we're constantly wrestling with that.
Yeah.
I know in my own life, which, you know, not to be extensive about this, but I look back at an experience right now is just very, very rich. And, you know, the pain and the struggle and the fractures are all a part of this larger story that I now understand as indispensable and inseparable from everything else.
Right.
But in the moment and in the particular passages, it's tempting to want a different story authored immediately.
Yeah. Well, that's what I appreciate. One of the things I appreciate about you being here now is because we were supposed to get together back in 2007 or something or other, whenever that theology and peace meeting.
2012,
that's what it was. 2012, see, you have good recall. But 2012, you're supposed to come and speak at the theology and peace meeting, I think it was in Baltimore, and there was something going on in your life, and it didn't happen. But now, 7 years later, you're here, and you're smiling, you're happy, you're full of life. That you've gone through that thing. So to be on this journey of disciples is to go through those moments, like you're saying, and then come through and re-encounter and in a greater richness. We kind of hope that for all the people who've been involved in theology and peace along the way, you know, we've all and other such movements are trying to express and render, what should we say, sociologically real. In other words, you know, how do you structure this understanding of the gospel as nonviolent? You know, how does this work? And there are a lot of people who are engaged in some way or the other. So we pray that journey and that completion and that resurrection moment for all of them. You know, I've seen him. I saw him. He's risen.
Amen. When I considering the life of Jesus in all these very personal ways. And at the same time, you were talking about atonement at the outset.
Right, yeah.
The living of this particular kind of life to its fullness, unto death, into death, in a way that's deeply human but unbroken in its love. And that that life is planted in the midst of human history. To me, that changes. We were talking about, you mentioned cosmic dimensions early on. Yeah. I mean, that's part of it.
Sure,
this is woven into history.
It is. And, you know, I've seen the argument in kind of academic terms that, you know, what is it? What is the hope? It's not even hope, if you're talking about academically, but what is the perspective in which humanity can survive, in which humanity, which is this really difficult project, if you call it a project, it seems more chaotic than a project. You've got this crazy multiplication of the species, human species on Earth, billions and billions being born in my own, our lifetime.
Right.
You know, it's gone up basically 5 billion in our lifetime.
Yeah.
This huge number is probably almost as many as ever lived, you know, human beings have ever lived in our lifetime. So it's at the best, it's a chaotic project. So you say, well, what is it that can make this succeed? It doesn't look like it can succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read the other day about a group that's, you know, and everything happens online. It's like they used to say all the evil things in the world used to end up in Rome. Well, no, all the evil things in the world end up online, or Twitter. But anyhow, there's this group that's anti-natalist. In other words, that human beings should not have babies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can see the argument, you know, that we're bad for the environment, but also we're going to destroy ourselves anyway. So why not, you know, I suppose what they're saying is do it somewhat painlessly by just running down the whole thing, you know, running down the engine. And so you have that kind of possibility of despair, and the kind of like philosophical despair in the world. So you say, what is it? What can give perspective of meaning and future to the humankind? And I think, I mean, and the answer I believe is the project of Christianity, you know, because it deals with this, with humanity, like you're saying, it's always invested in humanity. It's not otherworldly, although we've done our best to make it otherworldly.
Yeah,
yeah. But what the way we've been talking about
how
the gospel is invested in the world, yet at the same time, it's always teasing it forward, gives it hope. So you wake up in the morning, let's say metaphorically, and there is hope that, okay, I can try again. We can go forward. We can go forward. And I and Jesus is the kind of like the pivot, the essential symbol of that, that, you know, he kind of goes to the worst possible place, his death on the cross, which is, you know, this mode of execution devised by the Romans and before them, part of the Persians, just to find a way to make it as bad a way as dying. And of course, it could have lasted 24 hours, 36 hours, and Jesus was blessed in as much as only lasted 3 hours.
But hideous.
But hideous, that's right. And meant to be hideous.
Yeah.
Meant to be spectacularly hideous so that no one would ever dream of doing what this particular individual did.
Right.
Well, he goes, he chooses that. Mors turpissima, you know, the worst, the ugliest death, that's what they called it. So he chooses that with this amazing courage and faith in order to be able to turn it around. Now, whatever you think of the physical resurrection, there's no doubt he turned it around.
Right. Yeah.
The message, I mean, that's of course what Bultmann and people like that say, you know, that the message itself turns around. I think there had to be more than that. You can't overcome the hammer blow that the crucifixion is meant to be.
Right.
Just because you desire to.
Right.
There has to be some event. There has to be some
a way made out of no way.
That's right. Exactly right. There has to be a semiotic eruption that changes the significance of that worst possible death. And there was. And so he then was able to turn the human project, you know, the worst aspect of the human project, the bit that, according to Girard, we always depend on, that worst bit.
Right.
In order for all of the other good bits to work.
Right, right.
We have to have someone carrying the worst bit.
Right.
The scapegoat, right. You know. So he chooses that point, that locus, the most, as you say, hideous, disgusting, impossible place, human space that nobody wants to be in,
right.
You know. But, you know, unfortunately, many people find themselves close to it.
I was going
to
say, but so many people are in that place.
Yes, there you go, yeah.
And so Jesus is in that place.
Yeah.
And occupies that same place.
Amen. Yeah, and that's exactly right. And that's what the kind of stuff you're doing with the healing circles.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we, you know, involved in something that certainly is bigger than us, but that is constantly just opening to new life. The circle itself, the discipline of it, the staking out of holy ground.
Yeah.
You know, we utilize and engage circle practices and restorative justice practices. But we set the circle, the circle apart. And I mean, this is a very real experience, but it's also a paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And we prepare the circle for everyone to enter it together.
Mm-hmm.
And do that with a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And we gather outside and then enter in. And
oh, you do it
and then we enter into the circle. And we actually have the veterans lead us into the circle.
That's nice.
Because it's veterans, veteran family members, and people from the community that we call people of strong heart. And then when we sit down, I mean, the circle is closed in the sense that we're in the circle with each other. I mean, there's an openness in that circle will open to other people. But when we're in there, and so I think I said to you, it's both safe space and holy space, and it's also a crucible.
Mm.
It holds a power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the testimony of the veterans and the pain that gets articulated and just the depth of story and how violence has impacted their lives and the relationships that they give expression to for people, not just fellow soldiers and people, you know, that they lost in battle and sought to, you know, protect, but the civilians who died, you know, people who, you know, were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And the deep humanity of the veteran.
Mm-hmm.
So in the circle, it's an opportunity for the larger group to receive not just the story of what has happened, but what it means to the person, how it affects their self understanding. The pain that they want to give voice to, and I, you know, we'll go back to some of the characters that we've been talking about in the Gospels, who give voice to anguish and pain, and a truth about their experience, but also, you know, the truth of war and its impact emerges constantly,
right?
And then also the fact that military service itself changes people.
Mm-hmm.
So no one ever comes home, whether they've been in battle or not, they never come home the way they've left.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's a dislocation. My friend Roger, who's, you know, my partner in this endeavor, a Gulf War veteran, often talks about the impact of military training and dehumanization and being taught to kill and not to regard the humanity of others because... you know, the government did research after World War II and found out that a great many of the people who fought in World War II didn't actually fire their weapons at other people because it was hard to, you know, you're dealing with the humanity of, so training dehumanizes that. But I think, you know, what happens in that circle is an acknowledgement, a receiving and a witnessing to human experience. To anguish, to love, to connection. When we have veterans come in and they're talking about the civilians who have been impacted. But what happens along the way is the civilians are deeply impacted by this, the strong hearts in the deep listening, but also in the acknowledgement of our role in war, our connection to these veterans who, whether or not we agreed with the war, whether, you know, we're committed to nonviolence and we don't agree with war at all, These people serve in our name. They're our brothers and sisters, and we have a covenantal relationship with them. So exploring what that means, engaging in accompaniment, doing some of our own repenting for our lack of faithfulness, and the healing journey, and this is what I witnessed too, but the healing journey in veterans can often be one, things like forgiveness and atonement are very, very important. Mm. I don't say that in a way that imposes that on the veteran journey. But when I think of forgiveness being, and I'm thinking about the New Testament language about forgiveness, setting free from bondage, having burdens lifted, being set free, liberated for new life. The veterans, have a great deal of wisdom. Enormous wisdom that the larger community desperately needs. But it's in the journey, I think, of healing and transformation that the veteran becomes even more a voice and a leader, a potential leader in the larger community. Ed Tick's work gives some real shape to that too. But I think about the circle and how this, just our circle are with veterans, how we're all changed by what happens in there. And when I talked about that last night when we were here, and I said, a part of that solidarity at different points is when you're hearing a story and it's just desperately and awfully painful, and you want to get up and run out of the room, but you don't run out of the room. You're in the same world. You're in the same space. It's part of the same lives that you're living. And that, that becomes more and more apparent on the way. And so it's very local, and yet at the same time, has much broader dimensions. And Soldiers Heart, an organization that we used to do work with, would lead journeys where Vietnam veterans would go back to Vietnam and meet people that they had fought against and go back to places where they had fought and, had life taken or taken life. And those are profound journeys. And a part of my concern with people that I work with is many of them will never have a chance to make that kind of physical journey to where they fought, to where they served, and be able to encounter people and have new human encounters with people and places in which they serve. But when you think about a circle like that, we can do that kind of circle process, that kind of work, that kind of interaction in any setting. Gathering people together with a commitment to one another, with, as I described to you before, the learning of deep listening. After a period of time, you stop thinking about what you want to say in response, and you just receive and sit with it. And then maybe somewhere down the line, respond. And that's also why we use a talking piece, so that only one of us speaks at a time. And we pass the talking piece, or sometimes we have like an altar or a table in the middle. We'll just set the talking piece on the table and people can pick it up when they need to. But there's a great deal of the power of forgiveness moving in and through that process for all of us. And an unburdening, a recognition of one another and of ourselves in new ways. And of course, that's, to me, part of that as well. So,
well, it's a beautiful story and an image of the circle and what you've done. And it strikes me as I'm listening how new it is, how different it is. I just don't know how much talking of any happened at all after the First World War or the Second World War. We had poetry coming out of the First World War and we had some novels. But the experience of harm, harm done and harm experienced, is only kind of got in, it's kind of sideways. It's implied. It's implied in a kind of semi-heroism of those stories. But the fact that we're talking now about violence as such, and violence done to the human heart, because the human heart just can't bear it.
Yeah.
The human heart just does not want that. I mean, the human heart is a child's heart with a mother. That's, mm-hmm. that's essentially where we first, our hearts first beat.
Mm-hmm.
There's no violence there. There's a safety and warmth and love for, you know, at least for most people. To be talking about this is something new, and to be creating these circles is something new, and to go back to Vietnam and meet those people that were encountered violently in an armed encounter, that's something new again. And there's this slow germination. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it, and the church or the gospel is assisting at it. I mean, it doesn't happen simply through the churches. I mean, it happens elsewhere.
It
for
does.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, it's part of, it's like the Syrophoenician woman is the Canaanite woman.
She's, right.
She's kind of running her circle somewhere.
Right. Right.
Somewhere.
That's a great thought. I want to work with that image.
Right. And she said, well, I met this guy, Jesus. He was kind of interesting, you know.
Well, but each of these things that we're talking about is an interruption and a break in the cycle and the order of violence, and releases power.
Yes, it does.
You know, for life.
Yeah, and that's so important, because when I was younger, I used to think of nonviolence as very much a political option and a kind of like a kind of hippie-esque thing. You know, like it was a cool thing. It was like an almost attitudinal thing, but really through studying atonement and, you know, struggling with that whole issue, it's only very secondarily political, you know, like Gandhi using nonviolence as a way of confronting the British Empire, or Martin Luther King Jr., etc. No, it's only very secondarily political or social. It's ontological. It belongs to the character of God.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something we barely understand, and we have to struggle with, because there are numerous passages in the Bible which seem to contradict that. Mm-hmm. God says, "Go out and, you know, whip their butts," kind of thing. You know, like, I want these people killed. And you have to deal. That's why the ultimate figure of Jesus, where he says, "No one knows the Father except the Son," is so crucial.
Mm-hmm.
He poses this major interruption,
mm-hmm.
to use your word. In the human narrative, okay, the bets are off. That story is over. That narrative is over, and I'm starting a new one.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Not because, you know, I've got this sudden enlightenment. Because you've always had it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You humans have had your humanity wrong, and therefore you've got your theology wrong.
Right.
But now I'm going to show you a new humanity, and therefore a new theology. So this transformed narrative that we're now part of is really crucial for, and I just don't see it happening. I don't see it being, and neither would you want it to be being proclaimed from the ex cathedra, from the high altars of Christendom.
Right.
It's rising up from those who've been wounded,
yes.
and people like you who are ministering to them, that this new understanding of what it means to be human. And we'll never. And so, you know, after the First World War, they said, you know, that's the, well, during it and after, they said, that's the last of all the wars. And 20 years later, they had another one, worse one. You mm-hmm. know, why? Because you can't make that decision mechanically, and you can't make it out of the present order of things. It just won't work. Something mm-hmm. has to rise up, mm-hmm. like the Canaanite woman saying that new thing that changed the conversation radically. Something has to rise up, and it is, that's what I'm saying, it is rising up, and it is happening. And ultimately, and this is my big hope, is that it will attain the status of a word, you know, of a language that people recognize in the world. I mean, it's present in the circles, absolutely, and it's a blessed thing. And in some ways, you kind of almost don't want it to be more than that, because, you know, when it becomes a word in the world, then you know that there's a huge danger someone's going to get hold of it and, you know, make a power structure out of it.
Right. Well, you can pretty much count on at least an attempt.
That's right. But if it rises out of this suffering, you know, which is where it's coming from now, and out of this wretchedness of humanity at this crossroads, then yes, then we can change the language and change the conversation. That's what I'm, you know, hoping for. That's That's what theology means to me. Changing this human conversation. That's mm-hmm. what it means. Mm-hmm. That's what theology... Everything else is redundant, you know. Mm-hmm. The whole business of salvation, what it means, you know, in terms of an afterlife. Which church has the correct message, you know? Well,
you know, thankfully... You know, that era, which has been long and tortured, is falling away.
It is falling away. It is falling away. Just by dint of decay. It's decaying away. And
thank God.
Amen. So this other thing, this theology of the word of nonviolence in the world, is rising up, and that's kind of what we're engaged in. And of course, we, you know, we're fallible human beings. We're not perfect. I'm not perfect. make mistakes and are part of the old order all the time. But, you know, Jesus says, go forth and teach all nations. Mm-hmm. He says, there's something here to teach, something here to talk about. Keep talking about it. Mm-hmm. You might understand it one day. So, yes, I mean, I think this is a very exciting moment, you know, in the Christian story. I see it as incredibly vigorous and vital. This particular, I mean, like at our meeting last night, we had a half a dozen people basically. Mm-hmm. But what does that matter? Is that important? It's the strength of the conversation that counts. You know, changing the paradigm.
Indeed, you were talking about this language and this new language, and I was thinking, and I'll relate to, you know, the gathering last night.
Yeah, right.
That language is not only something that we learn. It seems to me that language, in some form, is already inside of us.
Right.
And we, you know, are inspired, accompanied, invited to articulate it, mm-hmm. or to find ways mm-hmm. of articulating
right.
it.
Right, right, absolutely.
I mean, to me, that sounds salvific. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think as a preacher, salvation's in every one of my sermons. Mm-hmm. But when I think about salvation, I'm thinking about all these different forms of people being freed, mm-hmm. and being delivered, mm-hmm. Or gaining greater access to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, to the depth and the softness of our own hearts.
Amen. Yeah. Liquidity of our hearts, you know, like they're not hard. I mean, they have to flow. Mm-hmm. To be human, you have to flow. I think there's this mystery of what's present in each person, and yet we need to talk about it. Mm-hmm. For it to be
right,
we need to have a conversation. You know, it's there, but we need to put it in words, and we need someone else to listen like you do, and mm-hmm. or talk to us, and we need to listen. I mean, that's the beauty of the human thing, you know, that we have this conversation going, right. You know.
Well, as we risk pouring forth our humanity.
Right.
And in doing that, making room for another's humanity to be received.
Right.
It's in that context
right.
that things change.
Right.
And as I said before, for me, it's I come to know myself better and experience my own God-given life more deeply, always in relationship with other people.
Mm. Amen.
And people tell me things about me that I don't know.
Yeah, right. Oh, really?
Yeah. Or I don't know well.
Yeah, right.
Or that I don't recognize. Yeah. You know, I sort of think that the kind of life that we're talking about, you know, and I call it the foregiving life, is a life of constant revelation and wonder.
Mm.
And, you know, when we were talking before about the sharing of pain, I mean, that's the sharing of our most vulnerable selves. And it's also a witness to a violent order and what it does to our humanity.
Mm-hmm. Really?
But there is healing in the sharing, in the testimony, in the psalmic expression, wherever it comes from,
right.
whatever it is that invites it
absolutely.
Out.
It reminds what you just said. Reminds me of a pretty classic Christian passage, a kind of a locus classicus for Christian culture, and that's the Confessions of Augustine. And this conversation he had with his mother, Monica, I think before he returned to Rome, I think they're in North Africa. Anyhow, the whole deal is that he describes how they kind of climbed up together in this conversation, higher and higher, until they got almost the vision of the heavenly realm. And I can imagine that happening. You know, they encouraged each other mimetically, conversationally, in this kind of platonic understanding of the gospel. But what we're doing is we're, rather than climbing up, we're digging down.
Yes.
And that's what you do in the circles. And we dig down with joy and pleasure. I mean, digging is harder work than climbing. Climbing is exhilarating because you get these wonderful views. But digging is, you get, you know, it's down and dirty and it's tough dislodging the rocks and stuff.
But you're in the earth.
But you're in the earth. You're in the earth. And so, you know, with all due respect to the Archbishop of Hippo, I think the downward dog, the downward dirty digging conversation is much more valid than the upward ecstatic heavenly conversation, because that was so mediated by Greek thought. This is mediated by the crisis of our humanity, which we've been forced to, and so we keep digging. And to further the metaphor a bit, you know, the gold and the diamonds appear.
Well, yeah, I would assert that, you know, I think this is the territory we're exploring, that, you know, the grace, the graciousness of God.
Right.
You have used more than once in writing recently, you know, the word unfathomable.
Unfathomable. Yeah. The unfathomable giving of God.
The unfathomable giving of God. That when we have any experience or have access to the experience of that, or able to witness to it, especially with other people, that there's a power in that. You know, it's one thing for us theologically to say, I'd stake my life on this, but it's that earth that's going to matter. That it's God's love that saves us. The forgiveness of that love, the actual character, if it's still limiting language, the self of God.
Yeah, right.
That is kind of endless in its outpouring.
Amen.
That is what comes to define our, it has always defined our lives, but we come to realize that. But it's also in personal encounters and in community that we get to explore that together. And I was thinking about that last night, you know, as your Wood Hath Hope community gathered here, and I was just able to be a part of that, that's the real experience of it.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing, I know this as a pastor, to say to someone, you know, God loves you.
Yeah.
And I will say that any and every way that I can. But what's critical is that people have some experience of the depth of that love and what that love even means in life. And it seems to me that over time, as we spend time with one another, as quite honestly, we have a chance to love one another. We recognize that.
I mean, we essentially, we're doing the same thing. We were a circle. We're a circle of conversation that goes on over a long period of time. We have studied the Bible formally, you know, which is a little bit more didactic. On, you know, I would be the teacher, but, you know, lately we've been doing more of that kind of circle work. And it is in that conversation that this humanization takes place, and that we become more and more this other thing that God intends us to be, and that God's giving. I mean, the whole thing about the unfathomable giving of God is that it is literally inconceivable. And philosophically, it's hard to acknowledge, because something that pours itself out infinitely is beyond our experience in the objective world in which we live.
We'll never get our minds around it.
No, we'll never get it. That's right.
And it's something that is intended to be received.
Yes, that's right.
But then, you know, you have a church that will tell you, well, you have to receive this, whatever it is, in order to be saved. And I just like, let's take that which is the source of our life and do more violence to it with our theology.
That's right. There's an implied threat. If you don't get that, if you don't receive, then there's going to be a big comeback. And I'm actually administering that comeback by implication to you. So, I mean, the thing is that this is a new possibility for humanity. And of course, I suppose religions, all the great religions in some ways have spoken of that, but not so persuasively, I think, in terms of love that we get in the Gospels, mm-hmm. you know, because we have this incredible figure who does pour himself out. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's the, you get that at the end of the suffering servant passage in chapter 53, because he poured himself out to death, God made many righteous through him, you know, because he poured out his soul, poured out his life, his breath. Mm-hmm. So that there is an image of that within the human spirit. So when I say that it's not true in the objective world, that's not entirely true. That's what the gospel is. Right. The gospel says, you know, that actually has happened and we can talk about it. And so it's very hard for us to as you say, to get our heads around it and to get our hearts around it, because my natural thing is that if I do this, if I'm talking to you this morning, I want something back.
I
give X amount of product in order to get Y back in terms of that's going to compensate me. So there's always an interaction, a transaction. And
we've been conditioned that way so deeply that it's a programming.
It is a programming. And even almost like physically, you know, the exchange of charges on the electronic level, the small particle level, there's always this kind of buzzing. I mean, I don't understand it, but there's always buzzing around of charges and interactions, and that ways things still stay. So to give that all up, to give away your charge, absolutely, and not get one back, is unnatural. But we are taught in the gospel and in religious practice that to do that and to believe that is what saves, you know, and to move into that space. And again, you know, in terms of what is the perspective that gives hope to the world and to humanity, you say, well, you know, you have this vast universe, unbelievably vast universe. There's no way of ever crossing the universe, because by the time you've crossed what it is now, it's going to expand even further. You know, you'll never catch up with design, but something like that. You know, it's this thing that we're in extends beyond every possibility, and which is a small speck. So that is mind-boggling. But the only thing that can make sense of it, all right, I feel the only thing that can make sense of that is an infinite giving. You know, the only thing that makes sense of the semiotics of the universe. Why should this? That's the philosophical question. Why something rather than nothing? But then why this vast idiocy of the universe, this gross, grotesque thing that is out there, and which is such a minuscule part of it, unless there is this immense giving. And that's just as plausible to say, yes, there is immense giving behind it, as this is just an absurdity. What do you, you have to choose. You know,
right.
Does it mean something or is it absurdity? In both cases, there's a huge leap. There's a huge leap into that abyss. But the leap of love is life-giving. You
know, yes.
And extends beyond death.
It has its eternal quality.
It has.
Yeah.
It has. And so, you know, it is so coherent, the message of nonviolence is, you know, that God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that the world not be condemned but might be saved. Well, yeah, that is because it is giving God's self, absolutely, and that's the nature. The mind comes to an end before that. Your mind can come to an end before absurdity, or it comes to an end before the infinity of love. Choose, you know, mm-hmm. you have to choose. There's no way out of it. One or the other.
Right.
And they're both as equally impossible. You can't say absurdity is a better choice than love.
Well, it's humbling. In I guess I would say, back again to the language of salvation, in a saving kind of way, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If something isn't, you know, if say the love of God isn't unending, mm-hmm. if God's gracious, if God's giving is not unending, then we're going to try and figure out a way to administrate it.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and that's, the church has been in that business for a long time. Of the administration of grace. That's the you know, just this paradox. That's
God protect me.
Yeah. It is the kind of thing that you know, when you're in ministry,
yeah,
and you recognize that, you know, it's vexing.
Oh my God!
You know, at the same time,
it's more than vexing. I mean, it's dispiriting.
It is dispiriting. Yeah. But there's always other things going on too. Mm-hmm. No matter what the church, and of course, there's many you know, different experiences of church.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter what institutionally. Mm-hmm. I mean, sacrament is about gift, but then we administrate the sacraments. you know, here's, we're talking about life in a way that is beyond administration.
Yes, that's a good phrase. Life beyond administration, yeah.
And even when you're talking about just our different, the ways that we conceptualize the world. There's going to be, you know, our philosophical takes on things. There's going to be, you know, statements of belief. But along with them is going to be our life experience one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're going to be immersed in something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes, you know, that's a very isolating experience. It sounds odd to talk about immersion and isolation, but the human experience can be very isolating.
Right, absolutely.
And yet we also have, and what we want to live towards together, mm-hmm. continually, as a life not in isolation, but acknowledging, you know, our deep relationships with one another, whether it's in your very accommodating, you know, gathering room here, or whether we think about the world that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is choice in that. And then there's also a kind of spiriting that moves us along, that invigorates us, that encourages us to breathe deeply.
Amen.
Yeah. Well, this is a great conversation.
We have breathed deeply here.
Yeah, really. You know, we probably...
we've gone from the Canaanite woman to the edges of the universe.
Right. You know?